Exploring the Word is brought to you by Reclaiming America for Christ and the Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We welcome you to the radio ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We invite you to join with us for today's Exploring the Word. Here's Pastor Paul Blair.
This is Pastor Paul Blair. Thank you for joining us for today's edition of Exploring the Word. Today we're going to continue our series on God's providential hand in America. And today's topic, which actually will be today and tomorrow, as this will be a two-part series, is on the subject, the separation of church and state. Abraham Lincoln is credited to have said that the philosophy of the classroom in one generation will become the philosophy of the government in the next. For over 200 years, America prospered. America was the pinnacle of freedom. America was the pinnacle of morality and justice, truly a city on the hill for the world to see. Through free enterprise, we led the world in inventions and creativity. We were the most powerful and prosperous and freest nation in the history of the world and the most evangelistic nation in the history of the world. Then in 1962, something changed. In the court case Engle versus Vitale, the United States Supreme Court decided that the following voluntary prayer offered every day at the beginning of the school day was unconstitutional. Folks, listen to this prayer. It goes as follows. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee, and we beg Thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Folks, there's no mention of the Lord Jesus in that prayer. There's no mention of sin or our need of redemption. Simply an innocent prayer acknowledging God's existence and place of preeminence and asking for His blessings. But that was deemed unconstitutional by the Establishment Clause, the First Amendment. In 1963, in the case School District of Abington Township versus Shemp, the United States Supreme Court decided that opening the school day with voluntary reading of a few verses from the Bible could be, and I quote, psychologically harmful to the child, unquote. Reading the Bible could be psychologically harmful to the child. In 1980, in this case, Stone v. Graham, the United States Supreme Court decided that copies of the Ten Commandments could not be posted in public schools because, quote, if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments were to have any effect at all, it will be to induce the school children to read, meditate upon, and perhaps to venerate and obey the commandments. This is not permissible under the Establishment Clause. Well, we don't have to worry about that anymore because I'm not sure the school kids could read them if they were on the wall. But can you imagine this? This document that said children are to obey their parents, don't steal, don't lie, don't commit adultery, don't kill. These could have a negative effect on our children? Are you kidding me? On what grounds is the modern court making these claims? Well, they say that it's the separation of church and state. They say it's unconstitutional. They say it would violate the First Amendment or the Establishment Clause. Ladies and gentlemen, the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The First Amendment was made to guarantee our religious liberty, not to attack our religious liberty. The limitations was only on Congress and not on anyone else. In the old world, they had established state churches. And if you were a citizen of that country, you also had to be a member of the king's religion as his form of Christianity was forced upon the populace. That was called an established church. You had mandatory membership, mandatory tithes, and mandatory attendance. In America, we realize that that's not how Christianity is promoted. Christianity is an action of the heart. When you receive Christ as your Lord and Savior, then you choose which denomination that you wish to worship in, if you choose. And in America, there was to be no federal established church, no church of the United States of America as there had been a Church of England. But now, after 200 years of getting it right, for the last 50 years, we have gotten it exactly wrong. And instead of using the First Amendment as it was designed to protect our religious liberty, it is now being used to attack religious liberty and in truth trying to stamp out Christianity, whether it be in a public park with a nativity scene or in a public school, or in a courthouse, or anywhere else. Today we're going to begin a very thorough two-part series on the separation of church and state. I hope that you'll pay special attention to this two-part broadcast on the First Amendment, what's called commonly as the Establishment Clause, and learn how this has been turned on its ear. Rather than defending Christians, it's now used to attack Christians. Please enjoy this session. Session 8, the separation of church and state. Tonight's lesson number 8 is the separation of church and state, otherwise called the Establishment Clause. We're told today that we're not supposed to preach on politics. We're told that we can't have a Bible on a teacher's desk in the classroom. We're told that we can't pray in school. We're told that we can't sing Christmas carols around Christmas time in our schools, or reference Jesus at all in Easter pageants. In fact, they're not even called Easter pageants anymore in schools. We're told that cities and municipalities can't have Christmas trees. They're supposed to be called some crazy thing as a holiday tree. What holiday do you put those up for? We're told that you can't have a nativity scene in city parks. And why? Well, groups like Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, groups like the ACLU, claim that the Establishment Clause, which is a nickname for a portion of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, which allegedly demands the separation of church and state. In this lesson, we'll examine the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Even with the completion of the Constitution, there were still serious concerns about this new federal government that they had created. In-depth articles and discussions between Federalists and Anti-Federalists regarding the pros and cons of a strong central government were published and debated throughout the states. Some states demanded and said that they would not, in fact, ratify the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights are the first 10 amendments of the United States Constitution. By the way, let me pause and interject right here. The Constitution is not a living, breathing document. It is an established foundation. It is the written word to be interpreted as the founders intended, word by word. The Constitution can be amended slowly without reckless abandon. And it has been amended many times. The first 10 are what we call the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights are 10 handcuffs which place limits on this federal government. They were to ensure and protect the rights of the people. They were 10 thou shalt nots placed upon the federal government, limiting what the federal government can do and clearly protecting the rights of individuals and individual states, thus serving as an additional check on the federal government. First, let's read them all together, and then we'll make a few observations about the First Amendment. Here are the Bill of Rights. Congress of the United States begun and held in the city of New York on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 1789. The conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adoption the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government, will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, 2/3 of both houses concurring, that the following articles be proposed to the legislatures of the several states as amendments to the Constitution of the United States, all or any of which articles, when ratified by 3/4 of the said legislatures, to be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the said Constitution. Articles in addition to an amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America proposed by Congress and ratified by the legislatures of the several states pursuant to the 5th article of the original Constitution. Amendment number 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Amendment number 2, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Amendment number 3, no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house, without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Amendment number 4, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, TSA, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Isn't it amazing that we are now all guilty until proven innocent? It's not how it was designed to be. But that's part of the political correctness that we face today, refusing to profile. Folks, I want people to profile. If there was a bank robber that was 6'5", dark hair and a mustache, slightly pudgy, I would expect the police to pull me over and check me out. I wouldn't be offended when they did. That's just doing good detective work. And when there is a certain radical religious group that is responsible for all these acts of terrorism, it is not indecent to be suspicious of their activity. The Israelis do a marvelous job. Those of you that have traveled to and from Israel, don't go through any of the nonsense that we go through here in America. And their security far exceeds what we have. But anyway, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Amendment number 5, no person shall be held to answer for any capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Amendment number 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and causes of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Amendment number 7. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Amendment number 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Amendment number 9, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And amendment number 10, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Folks, the number one item on their top 10 list, the single most important issue included religious freedom, freedom of speech, assembly, petition, and freedom of the press. Now, we might think that that's an odd mix to be lumped together, but our founding fathers did not. And this, I believe, is worth noting. Amendments 4 through 8 all deal with some sort of the judicial process, ranging from search and seizure, arrest warrants, juries, and punishment. You would think that some of those, being of a similar nature, might have been combined, but they weren't. Yet we have in one amendment, the first, that combines religious freedom, assembly, speech, the press, and petition all together. Apparently, our founders thought that those were all closely tied. Now, we think today, what similarity is there between the USA Today newspaper and our church? Why would religion and press be bound together in one amendment? We'll recognize this, as we've covered in previous sessions. Most of the speech which the British government sought to suppress was the speech of the pastors. The press in that day was not as it was in our day. They didn't have a USA Today. They didn't have daily newspapers. There were roughly 24 papers throughout all the colonies. Most of them ran once a month, some as many as once per week. But most of the things that were published by the printing press were sermons from pastors like Mayhew and Edwards and Whitfield and Cooper and Muhlenberg and countless others that were printed and spread throughout the colonies. The assemblies that they referenced were groups of private citizens or legislatures, which frequently were held in churches. So you see where these five different items were grouped together at this point in time, and our founders didn't think it unusual to do so. The ACLU, or the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, will say that the First Amendment says that there's a wall of separation between the church and state. Therefore, you can't read the Bible in school. You can't pray in school. You can't post the Ten Commandments in school. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we just read it. What exactly does the First Amendment say? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Do you see the words separation of church and state anywhere in the First Amendment? Do you see any of the words listed separately in the First Amendment? No. As a matter of fact, that phrase appears nowhere in any official governing document. Now, remember what an established church was. The Pilgrims came out of an established church in England. The Church of England, the Anglican Church, required mandatory tithe, mandatory membership, mandatory attendance. And if you weren't a part of that church, you were in fact persecuted for breaking the law. That is what an established church was. At the time of the signing of the Declaration, there were still at least 9 or perhaps 10 states that had their own established state denominations where at least tithing was required. But folks, this was not the federal government's business. We could not install an official Church of America and impose that on all the other states. Remember, as we covered in recent weeks, the Declaration of Independence was our birth certificate. It declared our independence as a sovereign nation. It was our mission statement, our statement of faith. It declared our independence and our reasons for separation, but it didn't outline our system of government. In fact, the Articles of Confederation were drafted and eventually ratified to establish the law for this new confederation of independent states. But the new republic's political leaders soon realized that there were serious deficiencies that needed to be worked out. And they gathered together at Constitution Hall in May of 1787, initially to revise the Articles of Confederation. But before long, they threw those out and began all over again. That's one of the things that is dangerous about these emails that you see calling for another constitutional convention. When you call for a constitutional convention, then it's all open for debate, revision, or even tossing it out. And we don't have men in Washington that have the character today of those that gathered together in 1787. But they gathered together, and in order to form a more perfect union, the members of the Constitutional Convention debated and drafted and ratified our form of government by which we are still governed, the Constitution of the United States, and in addition, the Bill of Rights were added during the new government's first summer in order to protect the citizens from this government which they had created. Now again, there were 9 or 10 established state denominations at the time of the signing of the Declaration. There were still 6 established state denominations at the time of the signing and the ratification of the Constitution. The First Amendment clearly prohibits the Congress from establishing a particular national Christian denomination or oppressing those that are of a different denomination. It says Congress. Who's the limitation on? Does it say your local municipality? Does it say your local school district? Does it say that the pastor can't preach about government in the church? No, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What is an established religion? An official state denomination, mandatory membership, mandatory tithe, mandatory attendance, and you can be persecuted if you don't participate. The restrictions are on Congress. Congress cannot establish a Church of America and require your membership. And although some states did have their own denominations up until the 1830s, the federal government could not, and the federal government could not restrict your freedom to worship the Lord. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, when this came out, this was a radical new concept. People were concerned as to whether it would really happen. As a matter of fact, after the election of our first president under the Constitution, a devout Episcopalian, not a deist, but a devout Episcopalian by the name of George Washington, had been elected our first president. Citizens from across the United States wondered if he was going to choose a national denomination for the people. And history records that he wrote letters to at least 14 different denominations assuring them that this would never happen. Consider this excerpt from a letter written to the General Committee of the United Baptist Churches of Virginia on May the 10th, 1789, just 10 days after he was sworn in as president. He says this, "If I could have entertained the slightest apprehension that the Constitution framed by the convention, where I had the honor to preside, might possibly endanger the religious rights of any ecclesiastical society." What is the ecclesia? Church, of any church society. What this is referencing is a denomination. If I had any idea that it might possibly endanger the religious rights of any church society or denomination, then certainly I would never have placed my signature on it. Of course he wouldn't have placed a signature on it. What did the First Amendment guarantee? That Congress would make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. He wrote another letter to the Protestant Episcopal Church on August the 19th, 1789. It says this, "It affords edifying prospects indeed to see Christians," who? Christians of different denominations, "dwell together in more charity and conduct themselves in respect to each other with a more Christian-like spirit than ever they have done in any former age or in any other nation." Ladies and gentlemen, this kind of tolerance was unheard of, and it took some getting used to. Baptists, and Presbyterians, and Methodists, and Congregationalists, and Lutherans were all afforded equal rights, both civil and religious. These kind of questions continued to percolate up with each new president in the early era of our nation's existence. And of course, the most famous response was written by Thomas Jefferson, our nation's third president, who was welcomed to office by similar letters as those I just read from Washington. And on January the 1st, 1802, Jefferson wrote this now famous letter in response to the Danbury, Connecticut Baptist Association. The second paragraph of the letter reads as follows, "Believing with you, Baptists, that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, and that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Ladies and gentlemen, the context of the letter clearly demonstrates that the wall of separation was to protect the church from the state. The goal was keeping the state from influencing the church, not keeping Christianity from influencing public policy. Look at what George Washington said in his farewell address. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to what? Political prosperity. Religion, which by the way, at the time of the War for Independence, 99.8% of the colonists were some sort of Orthodox Christian. If you were to look in the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, you would find that religion is defined as Christianity, and that under false religions, you had such things as Islam, or what they called Mohammedanism. But religion and morality are indispensable supports. You know what indispensable means? It means that we can't live without them. We won't prosper politically without religion and morality. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism. In other words, don't call yourself a patriot, Barry Lynn. Don't call yourself a patriot, Americans for the Separation of Church and State or American Civil Liberties Union. Don't call yourself a patriot who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. It was critical. The role that the church played in the morality of America was critical. It was critical to the future success of this free nation. Look at what Benjamin Franklin said. He said, "Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters." Folks, that's one reason why churches are not tax exempt, but churches are tax immune. Because if you have the power to tax something, you have the power to control it, and you also have the power to destroy it. And the government was not to have control over the church. If you were to read the sermons of the pastors in the century leading up to our war for independence, the fear amongst the colonies clearly was that England was going to establish the Church of England over the colonies. The First Amendment protection guaranteed that this wall of separation was to keep the government out of the church, not to keep Christianity from influencing the government. As additional evidence, and might I say irrefutable evidence, evidence so obvious that even a dummy should walk away after this next slide and never try to argue against what I'm saying again. But these following slides are from this very radical religious right website called the Library of Congress. And by the way, my tongue was planted firmly in my cheek when I said this. This is not from Reclaiming America for Christ. This is not from Liberty Council. This is the Library of Congress. We thank you for being a part of our ministry here at Exploring the Word, and we thank you for tuning in to this broadcast as we are continuing our series on the study of God's providential hand in America. And of course, today, part one of a two-part message entitled The Separation of Church and State. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're enjoying this ministry, if you're enjoying this particular series on God's providential hand in America, we've made it available to you. You can call us at our church office, 405-348-1745, and order a copy for your very own. We have it available as 12 parts on CD, and you can listen to in your car or at home. We also have this 12-part series available on DVD, which you can watch at home or use as a homeschool class or use as a small group class in your church or even in your auditorium on Wednesday night Bible studies or something of the like. I've actually taught this series in my church in a series on Sunday evenings, so it's very appropriate for use in your church, and I think that your people will find it to be a blessing as well. Again, we've got the CD series for $19.95 and the DVD series for $29.95. You can call us here at Fairview Baptist Church to learn the details about how you can order a copy for yourself. Well, we thank you so much for being a part of our ministry here at Exploring the Word, and we look forward to being with you next time as we continue our series on God's providential hand in America.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We hope that today's journey in God's Word has been a blessing to you. You can find more sermons and resources at our church's website, www.fairviewbaptistedmond.org, or call 405-348-1745. Join us again each weekday for Exploring the Word from Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond.